ready. It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to the 80th episode of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. I'm so glad you're listening. I've got a great conversation to share with you this time with James Tynan IV, a Batman scripter who works on Batman itself and the backup features, as well as Talon, and is now taking over Red Hood and the Outlaws. James catches us up with what's going on in Batman number 16 and gives us a little peek ahead towards Batman 17 and what's happening in Talon, as well as talking about his favorite characters in the DCU. I'm sure you're going to enjoy his interview. Then I review this week's comics, and everything wraps up with news and previews, this time with Steve Davis. We have a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. I'm glad to welcome to the podcast today James Tynan IV, who is one of the up-and-coming writers at DC Comics, working with Scott Snyder on Batman and taking over Red Hood and the Outlaws soon. And also does Talon, which is another book I'm really enjoying. How are you doing today, James?
I'm doing great. How about you, Wayne?
I'm doing well. And it's so good to talk with you because I got a lot of questions, particularly when it comes to Batman and Red Hood and Talon, because there's so much going on there. I'm really enjoying it. I just got done reading Batman 16, which is a fantastic comic. I'm running out of ways to say tremendous when it comes to the Batman books, and it's great that you get to be a part of it. I wanted to ask a question or two about issue number 16 before we go on. Normally, the things that you've been doing have been backup stories, have been kind of unrelated to what's been going on in the front, but it looks to me like this issue has the story continuing from Greg Capullo's art into the stuff that you and Scott are working on.
Right. Well, with this issue, like, we were originally toying with flashing back, because the heart of this backup is conversation between Joker and Two-Face. And in the same way that the last few have all focused on a specific villain interacting with the Joker. So with this issue, we were going to keep it kind of isolated from the main story. But now that the big tableau scene in the main feature story happened with Joker in the throne room and everyone in their get-ups, we really felt that if we were to step back in time, it would interrupt the flow of the ending of the issue, and we wanted to ratchet it forward. We wanted to keep people on the edge of their seats and make sure that they were looking forward to issue 17. We didn't want to interrupt the flow and have them turn backwards. And the one thing is that there's the image of the platter that we've seen that we're starting to see in some of the other tie-ins right at the end. And we originally didn't have that moment in ours, and such a powerful moment that we wanted to seed that in here as well. And yeah, I'm really happy with this. Just having all of the rogues there together to play with, just having them bounce off each other is great. And I love the dynamic between Two-Face and the Joker. I spent a lot of time thinking about how Joker thinks of these three villains in particular. I think he enjoys the Riddler, but he doesn't respect the Riddler. He respects the Penguin, but he does not enjoy hanging out with the Penguin. But he does not like or respect Two-Face. And I think that they just have nothing but animosity towards one another. So it made for a particularly dangerous interaction there.
Well, there's a wonderful line where he picks up the top and shows what's on the platter to the Penguin and Two-Face, and Two-Face's response, just, I had to laugh out loud, says, "You have to be joking," he goes. And I just thought that was such a wonderful line. It kind of shows that, and Joker's response is basically, "Do I?" Which is just a wonderful bit of dialogue for them. You know, it's great when the villains interact, because we don't know exactly what goes on when we're not watching a particular storyline. And this gives us an idea, just what you're saying. These guys don't like each other.
Yeah.
They really don't, and I like that real well about that. Now, one of the questions I have to ask, and I'm dying to ask somebody involved with the story this question, ever since this whole storyline began, was that in the past,
the Joker's always been dressed sort of like a maitre d', you know, he's got a suit and tie on.
Right.
And in this storyline now, except for in like the at the end of Batman and Robin, at the end of Batgirl, he's in a suit again. But the rest of the time, including in Batman, he's got overalls on, like he works in a car repair place or something like
right.
that. And I was just curious as to, I'm sure this was done for a good reason, and people have conjectured to me it's because he's building or destroying something. And that, of course, is Batman's relationship to his partners. Is that why he's got the outfit on that he does?
That's exactly why. And he's been going around, he's been working behind the scenes, he has this huge plan, and he's building something. He's building something on a scale that we haven't seen from him in a very long time. And as we've seen at the ends of the tie-in issues, now that we're at the end, now that he's ready to make his final move and his final play with the whole family in his grasp, we're going to see him in the classic outfit. So it was very deliberate from the start that we wanted him to have this very distinct look in this series, that it's him, it's not casual, but because it's very deliberate, but it's him kind of getting his hands dirty. So I think that's the heart of why he's been in the mechanics outfit so far.
In a way, it's made him spookier because he's not looking the way he is. Of course, he's got the skin from his face that was taken off, kind of tied to his head, which is a scary thing just to think of
yeah.
when you do that kind of stuff. And then, of course, he's wearing a different outfit than we used to seeing him in. So that kind of shook me up when I first saw it. I said, man, this is something. Something different's going on, and I like that real well. I always thought that the Joker, in comics in particular, because it's tended to be a children's medium, has been not well represented. He's always been kind of a buffoonish maitre d', you know, instead of being a seriously psychological villain. I always look to the Dark Knight movie as one of the very first times that I was actually scared by the Joker.
Right.
There were times in that movie when I had to turn away from the screen because it was too scary. But I love that now. Now when I go back at it, and after the first time I know what's happening, I'm not afraid because I know what's going to happen next, although it still scares me. And I think that this is in the comics. This story that you and Scott and Greg and everybody else involved is telling is just this wonderful example of how to do the Joker right. This is the way to make him. He shouldn't be a silly guy going around, you know, with bad jokes. He should be seriously psychological. He should plan everything ahead of time. He ought to be as scary as he can be. And this is the way I like it. I'm just so happy to read this. This is everything I've ever dreamed the Joker ever should be.
Well, I'm thrilled to hear that, and I know Scott would be too. We've put a lot of thought into how we depict the Joker here, and we absolutely wanted to get the horror quality, the fact that he's terrifying. Like, there's a great line, and I think it's in Batman Beyond Return of the Jokers, there's a reason we don't find clowns funny in Gotham. He is this specter that looms over the city that's been haunting Batman for years, and I'm very impressed with all the work that Scott put into getting into his head, and this Joker still makes jokes. He still finds things funny. He's still playing gags, but they come from this horrifying place that I think is true to the essence of Joker, for both the goofier Joker and also the very dark and serious Joker. It's this nice balance between all those different forms.
I can't wait for Batman 17. Now the bad news is I have to wait 4 weeks to see it. That's the rough part.
Yep.
God, I can't wait. Oh, man, I can't wait to see it. So it's going to be great fun. Of course, you've been working with Scott for a while now. What's it like when you guys work on stories together? Because you're working on Talon, I understand, and you're also working on the Batman backups together. Is this kind of a one guy dialogues and one guy plots, or is this kind of a you just sit down and discuss the whole thing and kind of work on everything together? How's that work?
Well, on Talon, it was much more we figured out the larger plot of the whole series going forward, and I take point on that. I write the month-to-month issues, and Scott is there as a mentor and a friend to look over my shoulder when I ask him to and make sure that I'm staying on the straight and narrow and putting out the best stories that I can. But for the Batman backups, it's definitely much more of a back and forth. We figure out what we want to do with an individual backup together, and then I tend to do the load of the scripting, and then we shoot it back and forth a few times to give it the final polishes and make it the best story it can be before we send it off to editorial.
God, you are so lucky. You get to work with Batman, my very favorite character. You're working with Scott, and I always call Scott and Greg Capullo the new dynamic duo on Batman because they're doing these amazing things together.
Absolutely.
So, man, you are so fortunate to get to work with this stuff. I understand you were a student of Scott's before you started doing the writing at DC.
Yes, that's true. About 5 years ago, I was a student of his at Sarah Lawrence College, and he was just really getting started talking to people about pitching for comics and stuff like that. And the two of us bonded, and we talked through, obviously, my work, since I was in his writing workshop, but also what he was thinking and what story ideas mattered to him and how to build a story. And we started a dialogue that continued for years. And as I started pitching things to comic companies and everything, he would help me out with those pitches and help me with the story and find my own voice. And once the opportunity for these backups happened, and he didn't have the room to take them on his plate himself, he wanted someone he knew his voice resonated with his to come in and work with him. And I got the call, and it was that was an incredible day, because I've wanted to work in comics my entire life. Yeah, and, you know, now things are going pretty well.
Great, yeah, I'll say. We can move on to Talon, because Talon's been another great book. One thing I want to say, though, is that I always read from people who are criticizing, and I mean that not in a negative way, but we're talking about the Court of Owls storyline, how this was the best Batman story I ever read. And now all of a sudden we're getting the same thing about the Joker stuff. So you guys just keep outdoing yourselves with that. But in the creation of Talon, it's been a really good book. I really like the way that Talons are kind of popping up all over the DC universe. You've got one of them showing up in Birds of Prey now. They're an All-Star Western.
Yeah.
They're also, now you've got your own very own book with Calvin Rose in it. Do you want to talk a little bit about how that came to be?
As people started to understand how big the Court of Owls storyline was, there were rumblings internally that they were thinking about doing a Talon series spinning out of the book. And Scott and I weren't sure whether or not that was something that really had legs or was something that was worth pursuing or exploring. And I remember I sort of went home over a weekend and just played with the idea. And I came back to Scott with a different way in to the Court of Owls mythology, someone who had worked internally and had got away and had spent years on the run, coming back after the events of Night of the Owls and trying to make peace with his history with the court, and finding that they weren't quite as dead as he thought they were. And so we both really, really thought that there was a story there. So we took it to DC, and it took a few months to get through the approval ladders. But, you know, I'm extraordinarily proud of the work on that book. And I'm really excited now, because now that we've sort of gotten all the preliminary issues out of the way, building the world and the premise and everything, the stuff I'm most excited about in the book is in the next few months. So I can't wait for people to read it.
Oh, boy, you've covered all the things that I was curious about, as you spent a couple of issues setting up things, and it has a little bit of a Batman Beyond feel to it, that Calvin Rose has this person behind the scenes who kind of instructs him how to move forward. Of course, he's not always going to follow exactly what those directions are.
Right.
But it's good that they're both tied into the Court of Owls. So the Court of Owls story is still going on. It's going on in Talon, which I think is such an interesting thing. Just great. Do you want to tease us a little bit as to what's coming up in Talon that you're looking forward to letting us read?
Well, I'd say that... I would say that we have some unexpected characters who are going to be showing up in the months to come that I think are going to add to the scope of the series. We're going to see the series move beyond Gotham again, and we're going to also see, and this is the big one, that a certain Caped Crusader might get wind of there being a Talon running around Gotham in the DC universe, and he doesn't know what he's up to or what he intends to do, but he is not okay with there being a Talon running around the DC universe.
Oh, wow. So, okay. Looking forward to that. That ought to be an interesting confrontation. God, that'll be great fun. Great fun. Now, other news that's coming up, you're spreading your wings, as it were, and now you're taking over Red Hood and the Outlaws, which is really cool. I've enjoyed that book, and I've been reading online where you've been talking about the fact that you're going to continue some of the tone that's been going on. And I'm just curious as to what it was about the characters and the feel of that book that drew you to it.
Well, I mean, I was approached to pitch for the series, and I've told people internally that the young characters, particularly in the Bat family, the Robins, they've been my favorite characters my entire life. And if there was ever an opening, that's where I wanted to pitch. And once this came around, I was extremely excited. And I think that there's just a deep richness to these three characters and their bond together, and the fact that all three of them have this inherent darkness from their past that they had to deal with. Starfire grew up in slavery on another world. Roy had to deal with alcoholism and losing the trust of his partner, Green Arrow. And Jason had a terrifying childhood, followed up by death at the hands of the Joker and a resurrection he still doesn't really understand. So we have these characters who have these traumatic pasts, but together they have a real bond because they need each other and they help each other and they make each other stronger. And just getting to play with a great dynamic like that, where these three characters could be off doing anything in the DCU on their own or with other teams or anything, but they choose to stay at each other's side because of how much they mean to one another. And I think that that's the heart of what I want to play with in the series.
It was interesting because this book got criticized when it first came out that the Starfire character was oversexed, or the sexuality of her character was something that some of the people didn't care for. And we've lost a lot of that since then. To be honest, that was one of the things I enjoyed about the book, that as an alien, she didn't quite follow Earth morals and things like that. And so her relationship with Roy was kind of a funny thing to watch. And are you going to tap into that at all, or is that basically something that we've covered already?
I mean, I think some of those beats have been covered, and I'm not particularly interested in diving into the controversy, but I love the character Starfire. I have since I first started reading her monthly, I think, with the Geoff Johns Teen Titans. That's where I was introduced to her, and then I went back and read more, and also in the Weekly 52 series from a few years ago, where she was going through space with Adam Strange and Animal Man, and I really fell in love with the character there, and I think her strength and her deep passion really mark her as a real standout character, and part of the reasons I'm really excited to write this book. I think her relationship with Roy is key because at his heart, Roy doesn't really believe his luck. He doesn't think he deserves someone like Corey, but Corey knows what she wants and she knows who she is and she wants to be with Roy. And that's something Roy's just going to have to deal with.
Yeah, how awful. I mean, what a terrible thing to have to put up with, a Starfire one. Spend time with you. Now, you've got two male character leads that I find really interesting. There's things I see similar and things I think different between Calvin Rose and Jason Todd. How do you approach these characters? What do you see are similar about them, and what do you think is different?
I think their main similarity is the trauma that they went through together as children and also growing up. I think they both have these paths that they're trying to escape and trying to figure out what their course of action is in present day and what it means if they are even a hero and what it means to be a hero. What is goodness? Is it just protecting yourself, or is it going out there and helping people because you feel the need to help people? And I know Calvin in particular is really struggling with that. And I think Jason tries to stay strong, but I think he struggles with his morality every day. He came back from the dead and he went out there guns a-blazing, but I think at his core is a deeply moral character who thinks he's doing what's right and reevaluates that and tries to figure out what is the best way he can be Jason Todd and what that means. And I think that's where his strength comes from. And I think that Calvin is driven a bit more selfishly off the bat, and we'll be seeing him because he's trying to protect himself and he's trying to protect the people he loves. It's a positive brand of selfishness, but he's not doing it out of altruism or anything like that, which is part of what I was trying to dig into in Talon number two. But I think that we'll see him face his fears with the Corps a bit more directly in the months to come. And I'm definitely also planning to throw Jason through a few loops where he's going to have to face what he believes and try to figure out what his future is going to be.
Well, speaking of futures, now that you're, as people refer to you as the rising star, or one of the rising stars of DC Comics, I'm just going to ask you to dream and dream big. I mean, if you could choose any project in comics, what would you like to do? I mean, if you could pick something, if somebody said, look, we'll give you whatever you want to do, what would you choose?
I mean, I would love to do a big creator-owned series down the line, something that could stand on the shelves next to Why the Last Man or Planetary or any of the Sandman, any of the great stories that are out there. Those are the books that made me want to write comics more than anything. I grew up on superheroes. I love superheroes. I want to write superheroes forever. And on that front, I would love to get my hands on Tim Drake at some point. He was my favorite character growing up, the third Robin, Red Robin now. I was reading him in the Chuck Dixon series and Peter David's Young Justice and then Geoff Johns' Teen Titans. And I don't know, I've always felt a real resonance with him as a character. and I would love to get the chance to play around with him a bit. I did the backup for Batman Zero and got to use all of the Robins in Batgirl. And that was just so, that's the thing that I probably had the most fun writing and one of the things I'm most proud of out there in comics. And I would love to get that chance, but right now it's also a dream come true to write Jason and Corey and Roy. I can't state how incredible it is for my first ongoing series to be a character that I created with Scott and with an entire cast of characters that I created. It's like that is a huge honor that DC trusted me to do that. And I love the peripheral characters. I love the characters that help build out the corners of the universe. And I would love to be writing books about these supporting characters and for supporting Bat characters and even in the larger DCU and beyond. Those are the characters that have drew me into comics and those are the characters I want to write.
Well, very cool, because Talon's a big success, I'm sure, because it's selling very well, and the stories are great fun to read, so I'm enjoying all your work, and I just hope you get to do a lot of writing on comics, especially in DC, for a long time to come. So I wish you even more success than you've had recently, and we get to see a lot more of the stories that you have to tell in the years ahead.
All right, thank you very much. Yeah.
Thanks, James.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Wayne's Comic Review.
Strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Who can change the course of mighty rivers, bend steel in his bare hands. And now, another exciting episode.
Let's have a look at this week's comics. The book of the week for me was Stumptown, Volume 2, Number 5 of 5, the conclusion of The Case of the Baby in the Velvet Case. If you've been reading my columns or listening to my podcast, you know there's certain writers and artists that I follow religiously. This week, one of my favorite writers wraps up his latest miniseries for Mony Press. Here's a description for the book. The conclusion of Eisner-winning writer Greg Rucka's and acclaimed artist Matthew Southworth's latest Stumptown mystery happens this week. Stupid skinheads, angry DEA agents, and extremely irritated Portland police are all focused on Baby, rockstar Mim Bracca's most precious guitar. Can Dex navigate the politics, egos, and attitude to get the axe back without producing even more tabloid fodder? Now, I'm a huge fan of mysteries and crime drama, and Greg Rucka has penned some of my favorite comics in the past several years, including Gotham Central, a DC Comics book I still miss. About 3 years ago, Rucka began Stumptown, which is described this way. It's a four-issue American comic book limited series launched on November 4, 2009. This comic book is a modern-day detective fiction series based in Portland, Oregon, featuring Dex Parios, a female private investigator with a gambling problem. A second volume began in September 2012 and has concluded now with 5 issues. Southworth's art it completely fits the tone of the story, so I'm thrilled he's been able to work on both miniseries. I hope he'll be able to do so again when, and I hope it's not an if, we get more Stumptown. This time, it's been a lot of fun to watch Dex venture into the world of music in Portland. Rucka's made me both laugh out loud and worry whether the folks in this book will survive to see another day. And making a guitar the focus of this tale has led to a lot of wonderful moments, not the least of which was finding out the baby is a guitar. For most readers, last issue seemed like the conclusion to the story, but Mr. Rucka had a lot left to share, so he thankfully received this 5th issue, which has its own share of twists and turns. One sequence made me call out, oh no, when I read it. It has to do with Dex's new car, but I simply can't spoil it here. It's got to be read to be properly enjoyed. So, Mr. Rucka and Mr. Southworth, when can we visit Stumptown again? Soon, I hope. This week's new 52 reviews. Justice League number 16 features the next chapter in the Throne of Atlantis event. Nightwing and Red Hood and the Outlaws continue their participation in Death of the Family. Batwoman has some of the best art in comics today, and it's so good that ads are forced to appear in the back of the book because there are all these double-page spreads. Wonder Woman guest stars in Batwoman, but the Amazon's own comic continues her recent story in a very interesting way. There are 3 GL books, Green Lantern, Green Lantern Corps, and Green Lantern New Guardians, and all bring us closer to the conclusion of the Third Army storyline. Catwoman wraps up her clash with Eclipso in the New 52, while Birds of Prey has the team adding its very first male member. Next, I enjoyed DC Universe, which concluded a black and blue story, teaming Black Lightning and Blue Devil. The book has now been canceled, so only a few more issues to go, unfortunately. Legion of Superheroes features the teens taking on Validus, or do they? Supergirl number 16 and Superboy Annual provide more of the Hell on Earth story, but don't conclude it, of all things. Constantine appears in Sword of Sorcery number 4. Then sadly, we get the last issue of Blue Beetle, and that character's tale is expected to continue in Threshold in the near future. Also out are, from DC, Before Watchmen, Minutemen 6 of 6, JSA Liberty Files, The Whistling Skull number 2, and Young Justice number 24, the next to last issue for that book. From Boom, we get Peanuts volume 2 number 5, and Steed and Mrs. Peel ongoing number 4. Dynamite provides Bionic Woman number 7, Lord of the Jungle number 12, Masks number 3, and The Spider number 8. From IDW, we get Star Trek Countdown to Darkness number 1. From Image, Chew number 31, and from Valiant, Harbinger number 8 and Exo Man of War number 9. And those are the books that came out this week.
It's time for this week's news and previews, and with me this week is Steve Davis, who returns to talk about what's out and what's coming out. So how are you doing today, Steve?
Not too bad. Thanks for having me.
Good. It's good to talk with you. Now, one of the things we wanted to talk about was the upcoming part two of The Dark Knight Returns, which should be out in the next week. And you've seen part one. What did you think of part one?
I thought it was very good. I'm a big fan of the original graphic novel. Yeah, I wasn't sure if they were going to be able to do justice to it, and I think they did.
Yeah, I have to say that it gave me the feeling that I had when I first read those first two books. And, gosh, it was so good. It's just amazing to me. And, of course, the very last thing that we see is Michael Emerson as the Joker saying the word darling. And the way he says it is really kind of creepy.
It is creepy. And I was wondering how they were going to split it up, what the last scene would be, if it was going to make you think, well, you know, to be continued, and, you know, do we really want that? But that could just be a story in itself. It could have ended like that. It reminded me a lot of Batman Begins when at the end of the film, when the commissioner says there's some guy calling himself the Joker, here's his car.
Yeah.
Well, I'll look into it.
Yeah. Now, I've had the luxury of actually seeing the second part, and it has the same tone to it that the first part has. It's really interesting. It ends interestingly. Both of the movies end with the music at the very end, which I found an interesting way to do it. Now, I will say a couple of things, and I'll get your opinion later on after you've seen it.
Right.
I really thought that Michael Emerson, he didn't do as good of a job, I hate to say it, as the Joker in the second part as he did in the first part. Now, he only had a couple lines in the first part, but it's very true to the comic. It's very true to Frank Miller's story, but he doesn't have the same feel for the Joker that he did in that very first part. There's lots of action. There's lots of things going on. Things I didn't think they would actually do in the movie, they do. And if you've read the book and you know what I'm talking about, they actually do that in the film. There's a part of it where things take a turn against Batman, and they physically do it. And interestingly enough, Mark Valley, and you may remember him from The Human Target or from Fringe or things like that. He's an actor. He could play Superman on a screen, I thought. And he actually does a pretty good job of the voice of Superman. And it's very well done. I really thought that second part, when we get past the Joker part, my interest goes back up again. Not to say that Michael Emerson did a bad job. It was just sort of a standard job, which I was disappointed by, at least in my opinion. I'd be curious to hear what you think of it after you see it. But it's just an interesting thing. Of course, this is the last of the Warner Brothers DC-directed DVD videos they're going to be making. And I'm sorry to see that, but they do end on a good note, I think. This is a perfect one to wrap everything up with.
To me, that's the biggest disappointment of all, because I love those direct-to-video DVDs, and I just can't believe they're not going to be doing any more of them.
Yeah, I guess Mr. Tim decided it was time to move on, Bruce Tim, and I guess they'll have to figure other ways to do it. It's just kind of difficult. I have to say the direct-to-DVD isn't as popular as it once was, and of course you can download videos off of iTunes and things like that, which is why I was thinking they should continue in some form or another. They say that what they'll do is they will put out more animated movies, but they won't be under this in this pattern that they've done, so we will see more. But I'm sorry in a way, because what this means is we're not guaranteed that Bruce Timm will be involved. We're not guaranteed that, you know, Kevin Conroy will be Batman as often as he has been. All those good things that made those movies so wonderful we won't be guaranteed that those will be that way going forward. You know, Marvel's basically abandoned that whole thing. They don't do that anymore.
Yeah. Well, no, I love Bruce Timm's work, so don't get me wrong here, but he's not the only voice out there.
And, no.
And there are other people who can write and other people who can do the voices and so on. And I'd be interested to see just who else might have a story to tell.
Yeah, well, he's a master at telling stories with surprises and understanding what we as fans are thinking and not giving it to us, instead giving us a really good story. The moment I thought in the first Dark Knight Returns movie I really loved is Batman soaring through the air and the lightning bolt comes back behind him and you see his silhouette, and it's very reminiscent of the very first cover that appeared on the Dark Knight, which I got to this day is still a classic to me. I just thought that was wonderful. So to integrate that into the story, I thought was a real smart way to do that, especially those of us who know the books.
Right.
Very, very good. So, well, I'll be fascinated to see what you think of it. We'll talk again sometime in the future and see about it. But it does have that feel of reading the book for the first time, which is very rare for a movie to do that, in my opinion. So, something
special. I think you're right about that. We'll see what happens. I'm looking forward to seeing part two, and we'll chat about it then.
Yeah, something special. I just think it's wonderful. All right, let's get into some of the news. Let me run a couple of things past you. And some of the stuff I don't know if you're familiar with. Before I do, let me ask you one other question. Are you still buying Smallville Season 11, the comic?
I haven't actually done that in a bit. I plan to. I really like what I've read so far.
Mm-hmm. They had Batman for a while, and Nightwing was a girl, was kind of like the female Robin was in Batman Dark Knight Returns.
Right.
So that's been going on. That actually has come to an end now, that storyline. They're moving off into something different.
As far as that goes, I don't have a problem with that, the idea of a female Robin in Smallville, because Smallville always was a different take on the Superman legend.
Mm-hmm.
So now, why not have a female Robin in this? But
yeah,
like you said yourself, it's not anything new. It's, there is precedent.
Yeah, I have trouble with female sidekicks because somehow the notion is that a sidekick always has to have a sexual component to it, and I just don't think that's necessary. I think you can be, you know, coworkers or partners or friends even, and you don't have to have a sexual aspect to it.
That's
so
true.
I don't like that. But anyway, we'll move into these other things. There's the one that came on that I was interested in. There's The Sixth Gun, which is a book by Oni Press. It's a very good book, and I like it quite a lot. It's about cursed guns in the West after the presidential elections, like in the 1860s and things. And there's a couple of characters going along, and they use these guns, and there are six of them. And, of course, the girl in the story, she has the sixth gun, which is where the name is done. Actually, they say it takes place during the Civil War, but it actually takes place towards the end. And there's Drake Sinclair is the guy, and Becky Moncrief, she's the one with the gun. Drake Sinclair actually has some background with the guns. And originally, this was hopefully going to end up in Sci-Fi Channel. But now they've given a pilot order for it for NBC. Now, there's no guarantee that this will ever see the light of day. If you've ever seen the Wonder Woman pilot that was developed, that it's available online. You can find it pretty much everywhere now, but it never really got made. And so once that pilot was done and NBC passed on it, nobody else wanted to pick it up. So there's no guarantee that Sixth Gun will ever become a household name or even appear on the NBC slate of new shows anytime soon. But I like it because it's a very different thing. It's a Western as opposed to a lot of the things that other comics are. Oni Press does interesting stuff. So I just thought, what was your reaction to hearing about The Sixth Gun? Is it something you would like to see?
Yeah, well, I'd like to see it on the CW
mm-hmm.
because that's one network that seems to have a little bit of respect for science fiction and superhero shows. I'm not really seeing that with the other networks, particularly NBC, which just let Heroes, the series, die without a proper ending.
Yeah,
And the Wonder Woman thing, we know how that went.
I
heard about it. It sounds interesting. I'm intrigued, but I like to see it being given a fighting chance. I just don't see that on NBC. Hope they prove me wrong.
Well, they had the Bionic Woman and that flubbed, and they had they had so many sci-fi shows. Like Surface was one where there was one of those weekly ongoing shows, and it didn't do very well. So they struggled very hard with those things. NBC never, I think, really knows what to do with genre programming. They just don't.
I think you're right. That's my main problem with this. I like to see it succeed and how it's going to in that network.
Well, NBC does own, well, Comcast owns NBC, and so they own, as a result of that, Sci-Fi. So this could end up on Sci-Fi eventually.
It could.
Which would be something to see. So we'll see about that. That's something interesting. Then there's another bit of news I find interesting. The prequel to Star Trek Into Darkness came out this past week. It's working with the folks who made the movie. It's basically together. They're just doing the final touches on Star Trek Into Darkness. The book is called The Star Trek: The Countdown Into Dark, Countdown to Darkness. So what's happening is we're starting to see the setup for the film. And it's a very good introduction to it. We get a lot of Star Trek history, especially the classic series, involved with it. We see a former captain of the Enterprise that we haven't seen before in this rebuilt universe. And there's all kinds of things with Spock is having nightmares. There are several things going on as a result of the first movie moving into the second movie. And it's the art's good. It's a pretty good book. It's going to last about, I think it's, if it's four to six issues, I think it is. And like I said, the first one came out, and they are in the process of doing that. Now, let me ask you, do you like to read comics based on movies, or do you prefer just to stick to the movies?
I generally stick to the movies, but, you know, that could change because I've been thinking seriously about picking up the graphic novel for, and this is getting a bit off topic here, but League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which is a movie that I really like. And I know that took some liberties from the original graphic novel. And it just isn't that. So you could ask me the same question a month from now, and I'll give you a different answer.
Okay.
So right now, I have to say that I haven't really followed graphic novels based on movies. The only exception, back in the day when DC had Star Trek, I picked up the adaptions from the movies that came out.
Yeah, it's interesting because they actually have an ongoing comic, IDW does, based on the film. Now, whether those are going to actually tie into the movie, we don't know. We'll find out as time goes along. This is, by the way, it's a four-issue prequel, and that's going to be coming out, I believe, this summer. So that's something to look forward to. I'm very fascinated by the fact that they're trying to get Star Trek going. Now, you know, an anniversary is coming up for Star Trek.
Yeah.
And they're talking about having it possibly come back on the television again. Now, whether it'll be an animated show, whether it'll be a live action, I don't know. It's going to be tough to do. They've moved the Enterprise crew into the into movies, but they very well could have another ship on a Star Trek show on the television. I mean, the fan films are famous for having multiple ships going around.
Sure.
You know, so I don't know why they couldn't take a cue from that and actually do that and make that happen. That would be kind of fun for that.
Or they could do their version of Next Gen.
Yeah? Wouldn't that be funny?
That would be
interesting. Interesting how they reinvent them.
Did you hear about, this is kind of old news now, but about a year or so ago, maybe not even that long, there was talk that Michael Dorn was trying to have a Captain Worf series.
Yeah, yeah. He's been trying to do that for a long time. He always was disappointed when Star Trek Deep Space Nine didn't become Star Trek Worf when he joined in the fourth season.
Yeah.
But, you know, as much as I like the character and I like the actor, Deep Space Nine was its own animal, and they actually, I thought, made Worf better than he'd ever been on Next Generation,
I was
very happy. Yeah, I just thought he was a great character on there. He never was, in my opinion. We always just referred to him as Klingon Knows Best on Next Generation because it wasn't a Klingon. He was some guy that wore a Klingon helmet, but he never really was Klingon in there. So I'm going to touch it. While I'm on the subject, let me diverge real quickly. There's a book coming out next week, and we'll get to it very shortly in the previews. But there's a series on a Doctor Who that's coming out. Now, the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who is coming, and they're going to actually do a 12-issue series called Doctor Who Prisoners of Time. And it's actually going to feature all 12 or all 11 doctors, I guess it is. I think it's 12. I think we're on the 12th one, if I'm not mistaken, but I could be wrong on that one. I'm not as up on these things as it says. According to the description, it says, 50 years later, we pay tribute to one of the greatest pop culture heroes of all time with this special series, which tells an epic adventure featuring all 11 incarnations of the intrepid traveler through time and space known simply as the Doctor. So that's good. BBC is going to have a big special on it sometime soon as well. So they're working on that in secret. But, you know, I know a lot of people who don't want to read television people on the comics format. And to me, I like it if it's true to it. They just finished up a Star Trek Next Generation Doctor Who crossover, which I really enjoyed. So there's all kinds of good things on there. I think there are stories you can tell in the comics format you can't really do in the movies or in the television. So I really enjoyed it. In fact, David Tipton, one of the guys behind it, he's involved in some of these other things moving forward. So,
well, you can do that. You obviously don't have to worry about a budget.
Yeah,
for one
that's
thing.
For sure.
But you can't elaborate on certain things. Like if you talk, like, say, for instance, Deep Space Nine, the original, Deep Space Nine or Next Generation, or pretty much any show. You know, the a lot of the drama deals with the relationships, and they get delve into that pretty heavily. You can't really do that in the 12, 15 pages that are in a comic book.
Right. Right. But if you ever get a chance to read that miniseries, it was actually quite good because it had the Matt Smith Doctor teaming up with Captain Picard, and I thought those were the two ideal matchings. Although in the third issue of the miniseries, they actually had Captain Kirk with the best-known Doctor. I can never remember his name. Bushy hair with the scarf.
I don't know who you're talking about, you know.
Yeah, he was the best known one in America, particularly. So he was. They actually had an issue where they diverged from the current storyline and went back and showed those two interacting, which was fun, I have to say. It was great stuff. They did a nice job with it. So I thought that was a good thing to do. I'd like to see more of those kinds of things, to be honest. And see, this is a place where comics can shine because you can have, like, Star Trek interacting with Doctor Who. That would probably cost millions and millions of dollars to do in the theater or on the television.
Sure.
But you can do it in the comics for relatively little.
Well, are you saying that you like to see crossovers not just between Star Trek and Doctor Who, but, say, Star Trek and other pop culture?
What I've seen also, sometimes they've had, like, in the novels, for example, they had the novel version of DS9 crossing over with Next Gen from the movies and things like that. I wouldn't mind seeing, all four incarnations of Star Trek get together in a comic series. I don't know why we could. That would be fun. I'd love to see that. So that's one of my suggestions. I think the comics is a limitless canvas on which you can paint. And so to me, to do that would be fun, just like I think this thing they're doing with Doctor Who with all the different incarnations of the Doctor would be great. I just think there's so many different things you can do that would sell in the comics format. You don't have to sell nearly as many comics as you do have to draw viewers on the television. So I just think that's the way to go.
Do you feel that comics just isn't living up to their potential right now?
Well, I think it depends on your perspective on them. I think the comics right now, there's a lot of stuff going on that I think appeals to a more adult audience than it has in the past. Now, there are comics that are geared specifically for the younger generations, and some people prefer those to the current ones. I happen to think that as long as I have a variety to choose from, I'm happy. Because I like very much what they do. I think that, I don't think you particularly like the new 52 that DC is doing. And Marvel Now, of course, has their Marvel Now. And they are very much drawing in a larger audience than comics were just like a year or two ago. But the thing of it is that I think we can have variety. We can have different kinds of Batman stories. We can have different kinds of Spider-Man stories. We can do all kinds of different things. And I think it's fine as long as it sells well enough to support doing them. I'm all for it.
Well, that's true. I don't have the issue with that at all. I mean, obviously, they're a business to make money.
Yeah.
They have to sell. If the books don't sell, then there's really no point in printing them.
Yeah.
So I want them to be successful.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. A couple of years ago, store owners were wondering if they were going to still be in business. And now it's they're less worried, but they're still not completely out of the woods. But one of the things that makes me smile are the related television and movies, movies, the television shows and movies having to do with the comics characters. And one of the shows that started back up recently, and this will get us into a whole discussion of Spider-Man, was Ultimate Spider-Man for season 2. It just rebounded back on Disney XD, the cable channel, this past week. It featured two stories, and what's happening is they are working towards the Sinister Six. They're introducing the different villains that are going to be part of the Sinister Six. The first episode had to do with the Lizard, and they have a very unique way of looking at it. The doctor who plays the Lizard, he's actually working for S.H.I.E.L.D., and he knows Spider-Man in it, where before in the comics, he was a scientist and he knew Peter Parker, and so they've taken a different tack on it. And in the very first half hour, we get to see that. And in the second half hour, we see Electro get kind of upgraded from the yellow and green costume that we've seen him do in the comics to something that's much more shiny and electrical. And, you know, kind of he looks a little bit like Wonder Man did on the Avengers, Earth's Mightiest Heroes. Instead of being purple, he's kind of white and bluish, kind of electric. So what's going to happen is eventually in the sixth episode, we're going to see all six villains come together and form the Sinister Six and go after Spider-Man. So, have you been watching that show at all?
No, to be honest, I didn't know it even existed until I saw something you sent me the other day on, and that's something I'm going to have to start watching because that intrigues me. I'm really more of a DC guy than a Marvel guy, but from the description that I read, it sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I like the show. It's not as good as I think. It's getting a little more mature. There was a lot of silly stuff going on in the first season. The first two episodes of the second season are much better as far as the tone goes. And I understand they're trying to reach out to preteens more likely than me. And I haven't been a preteen in decades, so I'm convinced that they don't care about me as much. But it's interesting. They used to have that Avengers show I mentioned, and now they're going to switch into another show. They're going to have something called Hulk and the Agents of Smash, it's called, and also going to be Avengers Assemble. So there'll be several of other things. They have a whole Marvel block on Sunday mornings.
Wow.
So we'll be seeing that. Now, the Hulk other thing
Smash
that
goes together.
Yeah. The other Spider-Man story to talk about is what's been going on in the Spider-Man comics. And there's a new book called Superior Spider-Man going on. Do you know much about what's happening in there, Steve?
My understanding is that Dr. Octopus, or I don't know if he killed him, but Peter Parker died, and Doc Ock and Spider-Man switched bodies. And now Dr. Octopus is now Spider-Man, and he's being haunted, more or less, by Peter's ghost. Like all villains, I don't think he's a good guy. He's doing this. He has his own. He reasons in his own mind that this is for the greater good, when obviously it isn't. And of course, and Peter's whispering is there. No, it's not. You're still a bad guy, Otto.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about what's been going on with it was that in Spider-Man 700, Amazing Spider-Man 700, which was the last issue of the series for now, was where Peter Parker and Dr. Octopus had switched bodies, but Peter Parker's sensibilities switched with him to Dr. Octopus. So instead of being a pure villain now, he has some of Spider-Man's sense of, you know, great responsibility and great power and all that good stuff. And so the problem has come now. Of course, Peter Parker is a ghost following him around. And everybody knows, and I mean everybody knows, that Peter Parker will be Spider-Man again before the second Amazing Spider-Man movie comes out. We know that. I mean, so what's happening is there's a lot of speculation going on, and there's a new book called Superior Spider-Man. Dr. Octopus basically says, you know, I will remember, I will honor your memory, Peter Parker, but instead of just being an amazing Spider-Man, I will be a superior Spider-Man, which was dumb in my opinion. But anyway, what's going on is that there's a lot of speculation as to why this is happening right now. You remember a couple years ago when they decided it was time to take out his wife, Mary Jane. They were no longer married. Right. They had been married for like a decade. Mephisto all of a sudden rises up and says, nah, he shouldn't be married anymore. Forget it. And so it was like the last 20 years of continuity had been wiped out. So now what the speculation is, and I had sent you a copy of an article that I'd read on a website, where they're thinking that they're trying to reset Spider-Man. They're afraid that Peter Parker has things going too well for him right now. So what they want is they want Peter Parker to get back to the suffering Peter Parker that he used to be. You know, he didn't know where money was coming from. He was always afraid he was going to disappoint Aunt May. He did nothing but take pictures, and so he's forever struggling, looking for work and stuff like that. And Spider-Man was considered a bad guy. But Spider-Man is now actually a member of the Avengers.
Right.
And what they're trying to say right now is that he's actually going to be thrown out of the Avengers in the next couple of months. Because he's Dr. Octopus, and he doesn't act like Peter Parker. And so since he's not acting like a hero any longer, they're going to boot him out. So the idea is he's going to be considered more of a villain now. Instead of being tied to the Avengers and therefore he has to be a good guy, he's going to be tied to the back to the villains again. And that way the J. Jonah Jameson can go after him again and all the people can go after him. So basically what they want him to do is reset to what Spider-Man was before. So what do you think about that? Do you think that's the thing to do with Spider-Man at this point?
I'm going to show my ignorance here. How well was, before it was canceled, The Amazing Spider-Man doing?
Well, The Amazing Spider-Man number 700 was like the fourth highest seller of the year. Right. But that doesn't say how much it goes from month to month. They're struggling with what to do with Peter Parker. I mean, in the Ultimate Marvel line, Peter Parker was killed and replaced by a half Hispanic half black guy by the name of Miles Morales.
Okay. Let me ask you, okay, that brings another, and I'm not trying to divert the point here, at least to the answer to your question. Why do you think that Spider-Man died in the Ultimate Spider-Man series?
Yeah, I think the reason was because it wasn't selling as well.
Okay.
And so they decided, and they also wanted to make him more diverse, and I that's a whole other discussion.
Correct.
Do we need to take somebody's hero, a hero identity, and give it to a minority in order for them to be successful? I think that's a big mistake myself.
Well, to answer your question, what do I think about this? Resetting Peter Parker back to where he was before isn't going to help things, I don't think. Otherwise, the Ultimate Spider-Man would have done very well with Peter as he was. Mm-hmm. He was that way, as I recall, what I've seen of it. He was the guy who had nothing going his way in the Ultimate series. And that didn't work. So there's no reason to think it's going to work in the regular Spider-Man title. I like the idea that Peter Parker had grown up. I was, I guess, 2 years old when Spider-Man first hit the streets, and he was 15 years old. Well, I like the fact that he's not 15 years old anymore. I like the fact that he's grown up. And I like to think that if you have that much trouble in your life and you manage to survive all that, then you're going to be a premature, well-rounded person like Peter was.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're having problems with the character, I would just say, you know, just rearrange things somewhat. And I know they've been trying to do that. Have him, like they did, put him in the Avengers. That was a good idea, or the New Avengers. You know, just try to give him a new niche. Mm-hmm. Spider-Man's still a viable character. I don't think just hitting the reset button and just turning back the clock, they were pretty much starting all over, except for the age. I don't think that works out, works very well at all. I was really disappointed for the reasoning they gave for breaking up Peter Parker and Mary Jane.
Yeah.
They want to do that. They had a good reason for it. Well, fine. I'm all for good stories if they have a good reason behind it. But the reason was they didn't know how to write for a married couple.
Well,
that's a horrible reason. You find someone who does then.
You know, you can't blame Marvel as the only one that's done that. In DC, they've also separated Superman and Lois Lane.
Right.
Were married for several years. So I'm afraid they think that the basic comic reader doesn't like to read married couples who are happy. They want things to be sort of upset and sexual tension and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we're at. There's a line in one of the articles I read that made me laugh out loud. They're saying Dan Slott, who is the writer of Spider-Man currently, used to be an editor. They said that Dan Slott should be ranked among Spider-Man's greatest villains. He actually received death threats, supposedly, online for what he was doing to Spider-Man.
Yeah.
So well, that to me is kind of silly.
You actually gave the answer to the problems earlier. You said you like a variety. Well,
yeah.
That's what they need. They can go ahead. Reed and Sue are still married, aren't they?
Yes.
Well, there you go. You can have some superheroes who are married and some who are single and others who doing something else, and that's all fine. There'll be a niche for everybody. As long as you can write good stories, it's like what was that movie I'm thinking about? Field of Dreams, I think it was. If you build it, they will come. Well, it has to be good.
Mm-hmm. See, that's the trick. And there's a lot of concern that Superior Spider-Man is going to peter out, not to be too funny, but that after a while, a couple of months, Superior Spider-Man would be back down to Amazing Spider-Man levels, and something will have to be done. You know, they've had the Clone Saga. They've had all kinds of wonderful things that they've done to Spider-Man in some sense to get him up. And there's even what they call the Scarlet Spider out now, who's a Spider-Man kind of alike. And the terrible truth is that they just don't know what to do with Spider-Man right now. In some senses, I understand going back to his core, back to who the character really was originally. This is a long, you know, convoluted way to get back there.
Well, this may sound harsh, but I would say just get fresh talent to write the stories. They're saying we don't know what to do with them. Find someone who does.
Yeah, that's the thing. I just think that they need better talent. If you don't know what to do with a character except shredding that character and changing him significantly, then you need to get a new writer, in my opinion.
I think so. I think that's the problem. Another thing to look at is that the new 52, except for the new 52, obviously, we're just talking about Marvel. If you kill off someone, or if you say if someone else is going to be this iconic character for a while, you know nobody's going to believe it.
Right.
I remember back in the day when when Superman died in the Doomsday thing, everybody was buying the last issue, and it was all over all the news networks. And I didn't quite understand why, because I knew he was coming back. They weren't actually going to kill Superman. Nobody believed me. They all thought, no, he's dead. It's like Twinkies is now. He's gone.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
of course, that didn't happen. Then more recently, Batman died. I think even the writer said that Bruce Wayne is dead. And I'm looking at this saying, well, no, he's not dead. Someone else will take over the book and he'll come back. It's a fictional character. Bruce Wayne will be Batman again, lo and behold. So, no, thank you, it's Spider-Man. You said it yourself, and everybody knows that Peter Parker is going to be Spider-Man before the new movie.
Well, death is a temporary state in the comics, unlike the rest of the in reality. So we'll see. I mean, Steve Rogers passed supposedly, and then we came to find out that was totally untrue.
Right.
And just before the Captain America movie debuted, suddenly Steve Rogers was back, and he was wearing a Captain America outfit.
Sure, and you know, Bucky Barnes was dead my entire life until he came back.
Yeah, he's a Winter Soldier now.
Yeah, Leonard Nimoy once said, and obviously referring to the Spock character, nobody really dies in science fiction. Well, comics, the same deal.
Yep, too true, too true. Well, let me do a quick rundown of the previews of what books are coming out on Wednesday, January the 30th. There is coming out from Boom Studios, Adventure Time, which of course is a popular cartoon on the Cartoon Network. There's another issue of that, issue number 12, and it's got five different covers to it. And there's also Deathmatch number 2. I'm hoping to get an interview with Paul Jenkins, the writer of that. And there are actually six, and there's five on that one too. Also from Boom Studios, there's Planet of the Apes Volume 4 trade paperback is out, as well as Roger Langridge's Snark to Volume 3 trade paperback. All those will be out this coming week. There's from Dark Horse, there's Angel and Faith, which are related to the Buffy books, which seem to do pretty well for dear old Dark Horse. There's also the Game of Thrones Throne Replica Statue, which was listed a couple weeks ago. It's back again. I guess they didn't sell enough of them the last time, so they're getting out. That's a whole $295 thing, so better sell well. And then we get into DC. There's a bunch of stuff, of course, that I like. There is All-Star Western, and most of these are number 16. There's Aquaman, which continues the Throne of Atlantis storyline. Arrow number 3, which is based on the CW show. Batman and Robin Annual number 1. Batman Beyond Unlimited, which is based in the what I call the Beyondiverse, where Batman in the future lived. That's the 12th issue. They put those out as digital first, and then they put them out in these monthly comics, which collect all those from a month. Then there's Batman Incorporated number 7, which is currently being written by Grant Morrison, but he's going to be leaving that. Batman The Dark Knight number 16, with Ethan Van Sciver taking over the art. Before Watchmen Dollar Bill number 1, which is a one-shot. They've had a series of things called Before Watchmen, where they were talking about what happened before the Watchmen series that was written
right. And
by the classic team, of course. And that's on. And there's also that week, there's Ozymandias number 5 of 6 in the Before Watchmen series. So there's a lot of good stuff like that. Flash number 16, Fury of Firestorm, the Nuclear Men, survived the latest bunch of cancellations. That's on Green Lantern Corps Annual number 1. Then there's He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, number 6 of 6, but I understand it's coming back as an ongoing book, so people who like that book are going to be happy with that. iVampire, number 16, unfortunately that one's canceled, it won't be long. That'll be done. Justice League Dark, number 16, which is being turned into a movie. There is Masters of the Universe, speaking of He-Man, The Origin of He-Man, number 1, one-shot. Red Lanterns, which I really like, which is sort of a Green Lantern-alike. There's Superman number 16, Savage Hawkman number 16, which I also like. Talon number 4, which is spun out of Batman. Teen Titans number 16. And then we move on real quickly into other publishers. Dynamite has Dark Shadows number 13. Hard to believe that's been going on a whole year. There's Green Hornet number 33, which has a Phil Hester regular cover. That's going to become Mark Waid's Green Hornet before too long. Then there is Shadow number 9 from them. Then we move into IDW. in which we have the hardcover of The Cape 1969, which I really loved. I'm going to have to get that somehow. And we talked about Doctor Who Prisoners of Time number one. That's definitely one to get. There's My Little Pony Friendship of His Magic, number one, Dynamite Forces exclusive cover. That seems to be doing really well for them. It does well on the hub, too, apparently, the cable network. Then we jump real quickly into Image Comics. A big issue that's coming out is Invincible number 100. We had The Walking Dead 100, which was the number one book of 2012. I don't think Invincible is going to be the number one book of number 2013, but it's interesting when a book hits that number. So pretty good. Of course, Robert Kirkman, same guy, does it. And he's kind of a Superboy-like character as far as powers and things go. Then there's also Happy number 3 of 4, written by Grant Morrison, and a way out there comic in which this really grungy world has a little blue winged horse following this guy around and trying to get him to do the right thing. So it's kind of interesting. There's a Walking Dead t-shirt, a flag, and Skull and Crossbones. Both of those are out. Then we will have, from Marvel, there's several Avengers, Amazing Spider-Man reprints, Avengers number 2 and Avengers number 4. I guess they're reprinting the Avengers number 2. Avengers versus X-Men Consequences trade paperback. Then there's Hawkeye, which I can't believe that's still going, but it is, Hawkeye number 7. And then there's a special with Silver Surfer by Stan Lee and Mobius, number 1, one-shot for $7.99. You've also got the Superior Spider-Man number 2. We talked about that series. Second issue of that is just about to come out. Then we've got the aforementioned Oni Press book's Sixth Gun. The latest issue of that comes out 28, which is a good one. And I think that's pretty much it for this week.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, that cost me a good bundle. So that's all that's in there. Anything else that you'd like to talk about before we call it quits for this week?
You mentioned something that I was just thinking about. You're talking about well, we were talking about the changes and retconning and rebooting and so forth. Mm-hmm. Of course, a year, maybe 2 years ago now, Dick Grayson became Batman for a while.
Yeah.
And Bruce Wayne's son, Damian, became Robin. Mm-hmm. And I know, of course, Bruce Wayne's back as Batman. And for a while, Bucky Barnes was Captain America.
Yeah.
Steve Rogers took over the role. Obviously, Steve Rogers had to come back. Obviously, Bruce Wayne had to come back. But I think it really would have been bold, and I thought it was kind of, would have been kind of interesting if they had just left Dick and Bucky in the iconic roles for longer than they did.
Well, you know, there's good reasons why they did that. I think the Dark Knight Rises was coming out, and so they wanted to make sure it was Bruce Wayne in there before the film came out, so that the people would go to the comics and pick it up and say, oh, well, what happened to Bruce Wayne? You know, they want to make sure that the comics will sell if the movie does well. So that's what they've done with both of those. They brought them back just in time to make sure that the comics would sell.
I guess I can understand that, but I think that it'd be good if they just gave the public a little bit more credit.
Well, I think they don't.
I think it would have worked. Maybe not. I could be wrong. I know that back in the day when they killed Jason Todd, I know DC, a lot of people, they got hate mail from people thinking they killed off the original Robin. So I guess I can see your point.
Yeah. Well, it's got to be done. They've got to sell comics, and that's all what this is all about. And so they're going to make sure that when those movies come out and those TV shows come out, they resemble the comics so they can sell more comics. And unfortunately, that's the way it's going to go.
Yeah.
Now I'll tell you.
I guess I can see it, but it still would have been bold, I think.
Yeah, well, bold doesn't sell comics, I tell you. Okay, Steve, well, good talking with you, as always. Thanks so much for coming in, talking news and previews with me. I'm sure we'll talk with you again sometime soon.
Sure, we'll see you in Batman next week.
Okay.
And that's a wrap for this episode. Be sure to be back next week when I'll have an interview with Adam Freeman, one of the creators of Night Watchman from Kickstart Comics, one of my very favorite companies. I enjoyed the book a lot, and I got a chance to talk with one of the co-creators, and I think you'll enjoy our conversation. But until then, keep reading your comics.
Tell me if this sounds familiar. You hacked League systems, disobeyed protocol, and endangered your lives. And your initiative resulted in the capture of 3 escaped felons, proving Warden Strange runs Bell Rev as a cover for criminal activity. Well done.